She's got everything she needs. She's an artist, she don't look back. She's got everything she needs. She's an artist, she don't look back. She can take the dark out of the nighttime and paint the daytime black.
I'm Peter Valkovich. We're doing a series of interviews with local artists that we call The Artist Speaks. Recently, we had the pleasure of speaking with author Douglas Wood about his Spirit of Nature masterpiece, Fawn Island. I'd like to welcome Douglas Wood to the studio today. Doug's been referred to as Minnesota's Renaissance Man. He's an author, artist, musician, naturalist, and wilderness guide. He has well over 2 million copies of his books in print, including the classics Old Turtle and Granddad's Prayers of the Earth. Doug's won many honors and awards, including the Christopher Medal, Abbey Award, Minnesota Book Award, Parents' Choice Award, and Doug recently won a grant from the Central Minnesota Arts Board for Best Established Artist, along with Mary Bruno. Welcome to the studio, Doug.
Thank you, Peter. Nice to be here.
Now, there was one other award that you had mentioned to me that you had won recently. What was that?
Well, it was very kind of meaningful to me to win something called the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Minnesota Association of Environmental Educators for my work over the last 30 years or so, writing books and visiting schools and doing what I do.
You are referred to as the Renaissance Man, as I just mentioned. How do you manage to participate in so many artistic activities?
Well, I should mention that comes from an article done in Minnesota Monthly. Minnesota Public Radio magazine referred to me as a Renaissance Man years ago. So it's a nice tagline to put on stuff. But it's just a matter of a bunch of stuff that I seem to be able to do fairly well, from playing guitar and banjo and mandolin to writing for children and writing for adults and drawing and illustrating books. I'm really terrible at putting together barbecue grills or swing sets. I can't fix my car. So it has its limits.
So how do you manage those activities, though, as far as your schedule?
I do not know. I should figure out a way to do that. Some days I write, some days I practice, some days I write music, some days I work on books, some days I travel on airplanes, some days I drive and visit schools around the area, and some days I just try and figure out what I'm supposed to do next. But it's a matter of juggling and trying to keep things in balance.
But it sounds like you're rather instinctual about it. You kind of just...
I like to be, but it's getting harder to just do it by instinct and intuition. I find that I'm happier if I do have some kind of a routine to plug into and not, you know, necessarily worrying about what to do next or trying to figure out what to do next, but have it there on the schedule. So I've got a really nice lady who's helping me organize my time and helping me with modern media and computers and stuff now, and that is proving to be helpful. So, yeah, like I said, it's a matter of balancing, and having a routine and having a schedule can be part of the balance too.
Well, let's concentrate on your writing then, because I recently finished your book, Fawn Island, and I found it very compelling and inspirational. And
thank you.
I know that's going back a ways in your career. When did you write Fawn Island?
It doesn't feel like it. It still feels like a rather new book. But then I looked, getting ready to do the interview, and it was published in 2001. So I guess that is a little while.
time goes quickly.
I've done a number of books since then, but this one still feels fresh to me. And I'm sorry, what was the question?
Well, I have another question for you. What is Fawn Island?
Well, let me just read the very first paragraph of the book, because I kind of like it. It's in the introduction. Fawn Island is a rugged but poetic outcrop of granite in the heart of the North Woods. Draped with a shawl of juniper and jack pine, it rises out of the vast blue mistiness of Rainy Lake, overlooking a long sweep of open water, sometimes lashed by wind and wave, sometimes still enough to reflect the starry depths of the universe. So, it's an island. It's an island in Rainy Lake.
How'd you get the idea for writing it?
Well, long, long ago, I was inspired by the writings of a Minnesota author named Sigurd F. Olson. And Sigurd F. Olson was, at the time, in the latter half of the 20th century, one of the most famous conservationists and outdoor writers in the United States. And I got introduced to his books when I was teaching school. One of my high school kids came in one day and saw pictures all over my office walls of the North Woods. And she said, "You look like someone who would enjoy reading Sigurd Olsen." And I said, "Who's Sigurd Olsen?" And she told me, and eventually I got his books and was so inspired that I resigned from teaching school and decided that I was going to set off on this career of writing and performing music about the outdoors, which eventually became books as well. And one of Sigurd's, the first book that I read of Sig Olsen's was a book called Listening Point, about his little special place in the North Woods on Burntside Lake. In fact, 3 weeks ago, I led a weekend retreat, writer's retreat on Listening Point for folks who are interested in outdoor writing. And now I'm president of the Listening Point Foundation, which manages Sig's legacy and Listening Point. So it occurred to me when I was fortunate enough to acquire Fawn Island that it would be fun to try and do something like what Sig had done about Listening Point and write it about Fawn Island.
When you actually wrote the book, did it become something different from the style of that particular author?
Yeah, that's a good question. It definitely did. I had done a book about 10 years before called Paddle Whispers that became very popular in the canoeing community, in the North Woods community. So I thought I would do another one along those lines, which is sort of very poetic, very lyrical, block poetry, really short pieces. And so I set out to write something that I was going to call Northwoods Whispers to go along with Paddle Whispers. And that's what I kept trying to write, and Fawn Island kept coming out instead. And humor kept popping up instead of just serious pieces. So I'm not sure exactly when the moment arrived that I thought I would write Fawn Island instead of Northwoods Whispers, but it evolved, and that's the way it turned out.
Well, and the humor aspect of it is a perfect segue into getting right into the book. Would you mind reading a passage from the chapter Church of Peace?
The Church of Peace, right. "We have an outhouse called the Church of Peace. It is called the Church of Peace because I hung a rough hand-lettered sign on its door that says, The Church of Peace. I hung the sign there because my father told me that in the 1930s, his great-aunt Rhoda had named the outhouse on the old family farm the Church of Peace, and I always thought that was the finest name for an outhouse I had ever heard. So when we came into possession of the island and its lovely old outhouse, we named it the Church of Peace in honor of my father and great-great-aunt Rhoda and other ancestors and the essential spirit of outhouses everywhere. There is, of course, something about an outhouse that is very like a church. Once consecrated, a true outhouse, meaning non-portable, no plastic, metal, or porcelain, is almost always a place of serenity and seclusion, cool and dark, where meditation is the natural response. Songbird choirs sing from green lofts, while organ music sings in the pines. An outhouse is often located in a picturesque setting and becomes an integral and beloved part of the landscape in which it resides. Inspirational yet functional, outhouses represent some of the most lyrical expressions of human architecture on the planet."
And I love the humor in it, and the fact that it is such a secluded spot, and you're already on a secluded island.
True.
So why would you need more seclusion?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes you just do. For certain things, including just thinking and sitting and thinking. And when you close the outhouse door, it's kind of dark in there. So I cut a Minnesota-shaped cutout on the side of the outhouse towards the lake. So it looks like a little, it's in the shape of Minnesota. I can look out of it and see the water and the trees and the birds while I'm sitting in there. So I'm not totally cut off from the world, I guess.
Well, let's get into one of your essays, which is a little bit more on the serious side. And this is the essay that you call Huzro. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not sure how to pronounce it either. It's a Navajo word. And I think Huzro, halfway putting an R in there, might be about right. Sometimes it's spelled without the R. "It's late evening, and I paddle among the islands, gliding between mallard and crow, back home toward the fawn. The western sky hoards its last gold like a miser. Whitethroats and veeries call, leaving the tracks of their songs across the hush of evening. A loon wails from north of the fawn, another answers from the south, and they begin an antiphonal chorus, the rock shores reverberating wildly with their echoes. The canoe pushes its breast against stained waters, and I fly into the reflections of the sunset. Gradually the colors fade, sky and water darken to a deep indigo. A crescent moon crowns the scene, earthshine of the old moon cradled in the new moon's arms. Following the sun, it too slides away, and as the night deepens, the wilderness of the stars is revealed, the brightest ones, Vega, Deneb, Altair, dancing on the water. Fawn is now only a dark and looming shape against the stars. The air is chill and I shiver, pulling the collar of my wool jacket up just a little higher. Still I remain, unwilling to let the evening go. If ever there was a time for exploring the shadow shores of awareness, for probing the soundless depths of thought, this is surely it. But no thoughts come. They seem to have slipped away as irretrievably as the sun and the moon, and as the loons suddenly desist, there is only the silence of the stars, that and a profound sense of harmony, what the Navajo call hojro, the feeling of being in tune and at peace with yourself and all that is. This, of course, is enough. In fact, it is everything.
So you started out by wanting to get into your thoughts, and you ended up not thinking at all.
Yeah, that's kind of a nice surprise sometimes. It's hard to not think. Sometimes we have to go to great lengths with yoga and meditation and other activities to try and shut off the bells and whistles and buzzers and the thinking, talking voices inside our head. And sometimes when you're just staring into a campfire or a fireplace or paddling a canoe, it just sort of happens. And that reminded me of that Navajo word, hojro, which means being in harmony with all that is, a feeling of oneness and being in tune with the universe.
Well, let's get back into some more humor. I'd like you, Doug, to turn to page 57. I feel like a teacher here.
Good. I like it. Turn to page 57.
And you write wonderfully about being a nature guide here. Specifically, you mention what you call guide talk. Tell me first, what is guide talk?
Well, I used to be a wilderness guide, and I guided scores of canoe trips from Minnesota, the Boundary Waters, to the Northwest Territories. And it became apparent fairly early on that sometimes folks are in need of a certain kind of communication to sort of reassure them. And I and a fellow guide named Denny Olson came up with something we called guide talk.
So if you wouldn't mind reading from that particular passage.
Guide talk, in its essence, is the art of appearing to say something intelligent or authoritative without actually doing so. All good guides use guide talk, though of course not all use it well. It's a necessity, as important to have in your kit as dry matches or a pocket knife. Why? Because there are, on any trip, curious, anxious, or skeptical folk who want to know exactly what is going on, when you, in fact, the guide, don't know, or more to the point, don't want them to know. How much longer is this portage going to be? Not much. The worst is over now. Do you think it's going to stop raining? Yes. No date given. Are there any no-see-ums in the North Woods? Well, I've never seen any. Guide talk is almost always encouraging. Don't worry, that food pack you're carrying isn't nearly as heavy as it feels. This is just a little cloud-to-ground precipitation. Nothing to be concerned about. No matter how cold and wet you are, you're always warm and dry. Lightning almost never hits the same tent twice. Bears don't usually eat people. It's often instructive. You can lead a horse to water, but you have to paint a barn. A yellow bird never craps at midnight. And sometimes it's simply used to pose an interesting question or conundrum to occupy restless minds during a long day of paddling. My favorite, what's the difference between a duck? What, huh? What's the difference between a duck? Between a duck? Yes. But that doesn't make any. This particular cone invariably divides all members of the human race into one of two categories. Those who think it's the funniest thing they've ever heard, me, and those who think it's the dumbest, everybody else. It does, however, serve to break the tedium and to give people something to chew on besides jerky.
Well, I'm glad we're doing this on radio, because if this was on television, the audience would see me attempting to control myself. That was just brilliantly funny. So it sounds like maybe you get a little frustrated with people's questions.
Oh, no, not really. I just like to deflect them sometimes. Sometimes you don't want to entirely engage with everybody on a serious basis. So I guided so many trips over the years, 80, 90, 100 trips, and I enjoyed virtually every minute of it. And I really enjoy people, and I really enjoy sharing nature with people. So sometimes I do that through my books. Sometimes I do it with concerts of my music. And over the years, I've had a chance to do it a lot in person, which is the most authentic way of all to do it.
We're talking with author Douglas Wood about his book, Fawn Island. Let's get into another part of the book that I found very enjoyable, and that would be on page 85. It's called Moonlight Ledge. I have to tell you that it kind of eluded me It's written quite beautifully, and I think it has to do with the wonder of the universe. Would you read that, please, Doug?
Well, I think you're probably right. That's probably what it has to do with. And probably as I read through it the other day, I noticed that none of it makes sense unless you catch the joke in the middle somewhere about the two classes of botanical classes of trees, which my young son once decided were deciduous and carnivorous. So carnivorous is kind of the key word. Moonlight ledge, a last look at the sky before bed. One more view down the long, soft glow of the lake, bound by dark, silhouetted shores. A few deep breaths of juniper-scented, balsam-scented air. Suddenly the sky is ripped by a shooting star, light green, long tail, northeast to southwest. There are, according to a small boy I know, two discrete sorts of shooting stars at large in the night skies. Meteors and vegetarians. This is the same scientist who divides trees into the botanical classes of deciduous and carnivorous. Well, the classifications work for me. What they may lack in erudition, they more than make up for with a profound and honest sense of drama, of potential storylines. They are, in fact, useful reminders of Einstein's dictum that the universe is stranger than we imagine. In fact, it's stranger than we can imagine. True, a universe inhabited by grazing asteroids and meat-eating jackpines is passing strange. But is it stranger than one held together by string theory, populated by wormholes and black holes and quasars and dark light and antimatter, and W.C. Fields and the Three Stooges? What kind of universe would it be, after all, that would be too strange to imagine? Why, it would be none other than the one we gaze at by night and awaken to each morning and think we know. I turn and follow the trail from the ledge back to the cabin. I tread on early Precambrian bedrock, nearly 3 billion years old, and find my way by the light of stars that may have died eons before my planet was born. And along the way, I duck under the predatory boughs of a rather hungry-looking spruce.
The meat-eating jackpine.
Carnivorous, yes.
Yeah, thanks for explaining that to me, because I'm one of the people who didn't get it.
So I'm glad
you came into the studio today, if for only that reason.
Well, some people say coniferous, but carnivorous is a little more interesting.
Did you have a particular goal in mind when you wrote that passage?
Well, it's been a number of years now, and I think the goal is kind of twofold. Or the goal is, as you said, just to mention... alert people to the mystery and the wonder of this universe that we think that we know, but to do it in a kind of a lighthearted, backhanded kind of way, because I'm a person who never really enjoyed lectures that much, and I figure other people don't either. So if I can do something in a light way, then I'd prefer that usually.
That really strikes a chord with me, because there are great books out there, nature books, meditative books, that perhaps are missing that humor that I think helps to engage it with the audience better. And
well, I think I found that useful, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, on the wilderness trips that I would guide. Humor is great at breaking the ice. It's great at lightening a mood. It's great at just giving folks a sense of belonging, and that we're comfortable with one another. And I want the reader to feel comfortable with me, because, as you know, at some points in the book, we discuss rather serious stuff.
Now, in another part of Fawn Island, on page 89... you describe the stillness that you're seeking while sitting on a boulder, and I wanted to remind our audience that we're talking to Doug Wood, author of Fawn Island. Now, I believe you were talking about Boulder Point in that passage. Would you mind reading that to the audience?
Sure. I make my way to Boulder Point to join the silence. Along the shore, the lake rises and falls almost imperceptibly, too little to even chuckle in the hollow places of the rocks. Half Mile Island is hidden. The south shore of the lake is non-existent. Even Deer Island is just a vague, dark hint through the mist. I sit down on the granite, the boulder against my back. The lichens covering it are soft and pliable in the dampness. There is otter scat on the rocks, flaky and granular and pink, a memento from last night's crayfish feast. Beside it, growing out of a wandering crack, is pale pink corydalis, one of my favorite Northwoods plants. This point on which it grows is exposed to everything, swept by wind and sun, frozen in the winter, baked in the summer. Here the waves have the fetch of miles of open lake, all the way from Brule Narrows. Yet every summer, here the corydalis blooms. This morning the crash and spume of waves is hard to imagine. Even the occasional boat wake from points unknown is absent. No whine of distant outboards. The fog itself seems to swallow up all sound, leaving a silence as deep as the moon's. I seek stillness of mind to reflect the stillness of lake, a gentle dip into the soundless depths of being. But as always, the goal of stillness is elusive. To clear the consciousness, to shut off the stream of incessant chatter that distorts a clear view of the world, is difficult, even with practice. To face oneself without the shield of noise, even the noise of one's own thoughts, can be disconcerting. The modern mind, the turn of the millennium American mind, my mind, is something like a burnt bear in a cave full of hornets. Or, as ancient Hindu tradition has it, the mind is like a crazed monkey cavorting in a cage. Actually, a drunken crazed monkey. No, worse than that, it's a drunken crazed monkey that has St. Vitus dance. To be even more accurate, it's really a drunken crazed monkey with St. Vitus dance that has just been stung by a wasp. Well, bear or monkey, hornets or wasps, I'm willing to sit here in the silence and wait for silence. And eventually it comes. The bear and monkey relax and sit still. The buzzing swarm of thoughts, plans, speculations, and ruminations subsides. And I find myself on this island at this moment, on a weather-ravaged point with a boulder against my back.
Why were human beings blessed with such busy minds? Are we the only beings in nature that have to deal with crazy thoughts all the time and have to try to dispel them?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I know that we certainly are one being that has them, whether my cat has them or dogs or the fox or the flying squirrel or the hawk or the eagle have them. I kind of doubt it, but maybe they have to calm themselves. I got cats that get a little neurotic once in a while. They have to calm themselves down. So who knows?
If there's one thing that I took from Fawn Island, it's that nature has a lot to teach us. And I think in Fawn Island, you learned quite a bit of it. I'm sure that there's lots more to learn, but you've seemed to have come a long way in learning that fact. How do you feel about that?
Well, in the introduction of the book, I write a little bit about, what is it I said, that sometimes when I come to the island, or almost every time I come to the island, I leave with more under my hat than I arrived with. And that doesn't mean a lot of news that I've gleaned from listening to the radio while on the island, but more wisdom perhaps than knowledge, and learning a little bit more about what's important, learning a little bit more about the cycles of nature, about the circular form of an island that sort of encloses you in a small world but also opens you up to the big world. All those kinds of things are things that I find are really valuable when I have a chance to visit Fawn Island.
When you come back from Fawn Island, and I believe you were in Fawn Island recently and concluded some time there, and how does it feel to come back?
Coming back doesn't bother me, but leaving Fawn Island bothers me a lot. And when I was able to purchase the island about 20 years ago, I was hoping that I and my family would spend most of every summer there and a bunch of other time as well. And, you know, needing to make a living and do all the other things that life entails means I don't get to spend as much time on Fawn Island as I would like. And it's a 5-hour drive away from here. Rainy Lake is right on the Canadian border. So it's a trek to get there. It takes more than just deciding to go for a few hours. That also makes it more worthwhile when we arrive there. And it feels like we've really taken a journey to someplace special. And as I say, I always hate to leave. When I was a little boy, I first fell in love with the Northwoods when my family would take a vacation every summer to Lake Cabotogama, which is right next to Rainy Lake. Both are part now of Voyageurs National Park. And, I would cry every time it was time to leave Cabotogama and go back home. So I don't cry anymore, but sometimes I feel like it.
I want to conclude our discussion of passages in your book. Towards the end of Fawn Island, you talk about optimism, which in these times I feel is a great attitude to have. It's hard to be optimistic. You mentioned a mechanic you met who impressed you with his attitude. Do you remember Don?
I do remember Don, and I had fun writing this part. It's fun putting someone real in a book besides yourself and maybe my immediate family. Most of Fawn Island is written when I was alone on the island, but of course, you know, some of my most favorite times are there with my family and my sons and my wife, and now I've got two grandchildren, and so those are great times, but this was kind of about the solitary time spent there. But as I thought about this idea of optimism, I remembered Don. So let's see. Years ago, when I was struggling with my worldview and my self-view, I had a balky car that needed a lot of work. I didn't like getting the car fixed all the time, but I did somehow like the time I spent with the auto mechanic, Don, in his garage. One day I realized why. I was standing around waiting for my car to get fixed when another customer came in. He stood around for a while too. There seemed often to be people standing around in Don's garage. As usual, Don engaged in conversation while he twisted wrenches and calibrated things and slid under and out from under cars. At some point, the other man said, "Don, you always seem to have a smile or a story or something pleasant to say. You always seem to be in a good mood. How do you do that?" From under a car hood and without missing a beat, Don answered, "Well, I tried it the other way and that didn't work." I thought it was one of the most profound things I'd ever heard. Simple, self-evident. A mechanic, by definition, figures out what works and what doesn't work. If something doesn't work, quit doing it. Period. I took Don's words home with me and wrote them in my journal. But I needn't have bothered. I never forgot them.
Optimism is a choice, isn't it?
Usually, yes. I write later in that same piece that when I was a little boy, I always won the fishing contest every year at Lake Kabatokuma. And it really wasn't that hard for me to win, even though I had a granddad and a grandmother and a dad and a mother and two brothers and cousins and uncles and aunts. I almost always won the fishing contest. But later, when I thought about it, I realized that this belief that I had that I would win the fishing contest, which was very important to me as a young boy, didn't lead me to just sit around and not try because I just figured I'd win anyway. It was the opposite effect. It made me more excited to go out and try. And I'd get up earlier than everybody else, and I'd walk along the shore casting longer than anybody else, and I'd fish on the dock till the moon was up and the sun was gone, and beg to go out in every boat on every fishing trip because I was just excited to go fishing. And I think that optimism can be that way in our lives when we allow ourselves to get, and we all do, get down and feel depressed about things from time to time, and naturally so. But it's good to have to know yourself well enough to be able to grab onto something that you believe in, something that you know means something to you, something you can get excited about, to pull you along and get that optimistic feeling back again. And as I often think of it as both are self-fulfilling. You know, if you're optimistic, eventually you'll end up with an optimistic end result. And if you're pessimistic, you'll probably end up with a pessimistic end result. And I'd rather have the optimistic one. So, yeah, and at that point, it becomes a choice.
And to use an overused expression, follow your passion?
Mm-hmm. Yep, within reason. You still have to be a responsible person. I still find it important to take good care of my family and not just chase around the world after some flighty thing that I'm never going to catch. So again, it's a matter of balancing, like we talked about before, the things that you believe in, the things that are important to you and fire you up, and the things that ground you and make you a real person as well. All are part of a life, I guess.
So, Doug, what are you working on these days?
Well, I'm always working on more than one thing because I'm ADHD and I can't be focused enough to just do one thing. So I'm doing a lot of stuff with my little band, the Wild Spirit Band. We're doing a big concert later this week in Iowa for the Midwest Environmental Education Conference. I'm working on 3 or 4 children's books. I'm republishing an adult book that's going to come out this fall again called Breathe the Wind, Drink the Rain, that's been out of print for a little while. And then I was really fortunate to get a Minnesota State Arts Board grant this last year to write another adult collection of essays along the lines of Fawn Island. And the working title for that is Lifescape. And I'm trying to find that interface between our internal landscape and the external landscape that we travel in our various journeys and try to get to know.
Doug Wood, thanks for coming into the studio today.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me.
She's got everything she needs. She's an artist. She don't look back. She's got everything she needs. She's an artist. She don't look back.
That concludes another edition of The Artist Speaks. I'd like to thank Peter Velkovich for his production efforts and KVSC for continuing to make their studio available to us. Be sure to look for more interviews with artists of Central Minnesota.
You will start out standing, proud to steal her anything she sees. But you will wind up peeking through a keyhole down upon your knees.